From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. The Library of America has just published the first of a two-volume collection of the novels and stories of the late writer William Maxwell. For 40 years, Maxwell was a fiction editor at The New Yorker. His own fiction focused on the fragility of happiness and small-town Midwestern life in the early 20th century. John Updike called Maxwell's writing voice one of the wisest and kindest in American fiction. Today we listen back to a 1995 interview with Maxwell. He died in 2000. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a newly released live recording of opera soprano Patricia Brooks. And David Edelstein looks at the Romanian film 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. William Maxwell was a much-loved, although not widely known, writer. This year, to honor the centenary of his birth and his contribution to American writing, the Library of America will publish a two-volume edition collecting his work. The first, out this month, collects his early novels and stories. Maxwell was born in 1908 in the small town of Lincoln, Illinois, where he lived until moving to Chicago at the age of 14. Much of his fiction is set around the turn of the century in towns like Lincoln. Maxwell wrote six novels, several collections of stories, a memoir, literary essays, and reviews. From 1936 to 1975, he was a fiction editor at The New Yorker, where he worked with such writers as John Updike, John Cheever, Vladimir Nabokov, and Mary McCarthy. Terry Gross spoke to William Maxwell in 1995, when he published a collection of new and old stories called All the Days and Nights. She asked him about a story called What He Was Like. It's about an aging man who keeps a diary in which he records his private thoughts and feelings, thoughts that would astonish people who knew him. William Maxwell read a short excerpt.
"To be able to do in your mind," he wrote, "what it is probably not a good idea to do in actuality, is a convenience not always sufficiently appreciated. Though in his daily life he was as cheerful as a cricket, the diaries were more and more given over to dark thoughts, anger, resentment, indecencies, regrets, remorse. And now and then, the simple joy in being alive. If I stopped recognizing that I want things that it's not appropriate for me to want," he wrote, "wouldn't this inevitably lead to my not wanting anything at all, which, as people get older, is a risk that must be avoided at all costs?"
William Maxwell, let me read what happens a little later on in the story. A little later on, after this man who's keeping the diary dies, his daughter decides to read his diary, even though this man's wife has warned her that he wouldn't want the diaries read. And she's very upset after reading what he wrote. And the daughter says, "He wasn't the person I thought he was. He had all sorts of secret desires. A lot of it is very dirty, and some of it is more unkind than I would have believed possible. And just not like him, except that it was him. It makes me feel I can never trust anybody ever again." I think one of the things I enjoyed so much about this story is that I related to both sides. I've been shocked to find something out about someone who I thought I knew that made me realize I didn't know them at all. But I know I also have certain thoughts that would shock people who I know if they found out I felt that way. And I wondered if you too related to both aspects of this story.
What I feel it's about really is the exterior and the interior life that everybody has. And Wallace Shawn once wrote a play in which everybody spoke their interior thoughts. But it, if I am not careful, I pass for a very mild man. And if I let loose with something that isn't mild, all hell breaks loose. People have an idea of who you are, and you're rather confined within that idea. But meanwhile, in your inner life, you're perfectly free to think anything you want to.
So do you think people who know you would be shocked if they knew what went on in your mind?
Yes, and I'd be shocked if I knew what went on in theirs.
The territory for some writers is just that territory, those secret parts that are really shocking.
Yes.
Do you feel you've worked with those parts as a writer, or do you feel that even as a writer you've kept those parts mostly hidden?
I think they tend to be less interesting than the external life, because the external life is related to other people and full of conflict and involvement, whereas the inner life is a kind of mirror that is ingrown and repetitious and pretty much the same for one person as for another, only people don't recognize or admit it.
I want to read another passage from the story, What He Was Like. His wife's uncle in the bar of the Yale Club said, "I am at the age of funerals." Now, 35 years later, it was his turn. In his address book, the names of his three oldest friends had lines drawn through them. "Jack is dead," he wrote in his diary. "I didn't think that would happen. I thought he was immortal. Louise is dead, in her sleep. Richard has been dead for over a year, and I still do not believe it. So impoverishing." He himself got older. His wife got older. They advanced deeper into their 70s without any sense of large changes, but only of one day's following another, and of the days being full and pleasant and worth recording. So he went on doing it. They all got put down in his diary, along with his feelings about old age, his fear of dying, his declining sexual powers, his envy of the children that he saw running down the street. To be able to run like that, he had to restrain himself from saying to young men in their 30s and 40s, "You do appreciate, don't you, what you have?" In his diary, he wrote, "If I had my life to live over again, but one doesn't. One goes forward instead, dragging a cart piled high with lost opportunities." Do you feel that you've written a lot or wanted to write a lot about aging as you've gotten older?
I'm surprised I don't write more, but I'm a storyteller, essentially, not a philosopher. And an idea will pass through my mind about aging, about being old, about the good things about it and the bad things about it. And it's a kind of intimation which I receive and which and let go of. And I don't remember the next day what this interesting thought was. Only a very few of them have ever stayed by me. The very first one of all was when I was shaving and of course, looking myself in the mirror as I shaved, and I thought, "What am I doing tied to this old man?" And two or three days later, I had a second one, which was, "But I don't want to leave the party." Those ideas occur to you, but they don't seem to be related to. I mean, they could have occurred to anybody who shaved himself in front of a mirror and was in his late 70s. I don't think they have to do with writing particularly, or that I needed to do anything more than just have the idea.
Do you keep a journal yourself?
No, never have.
Why not?
It isn't true that I never have. I started when I was in college, and it petered out. It was so uninteresting, it bored me to tears.
Oh, I've had some of those.
Yes. I think journal keeping is a talent, a specific talent, like being a playwright or being a novelist or being a short story writer. It's you have a need to record your days, and you have a pleasure in recording it. And people who don't have that instinct don't keep journals.
A lot of the stories in your new collection come out of memories of your childhood. How much do you feel that your memory of your past has been your subject as a writer?
I think about three-quarters of the time, actually. When I was first beginning to write, I wrote largely out of the present. And was alert for any situation taking place around me that could make a story. But the present, though very pleasant, didn't seem to go very deeply into anything. And memories sit on the back of the stove like soup, and they get richer and richer from the things they attract to them, and their wonderful kind of accidental quality. But I also have a kind of abnormal memory, really. My memories go back, as far as I can make out, to when I was 2 years old. And I have quite vivid memories of what before I was four. And it isn't that I haven't forgotten things, but I have remembered things, more things than people usually do. And in my old age, there's an additional vividness to them, and detail, and the detail is sometimes so astonishing that I feel everything is there. Everything that ever happened to me is there. It's a matter of unhooking it and bringing it out to the light.
Are you saying that your past has become more vivid to you as you've gotten older?
Yes, much more vivid.
Is there anything that would explain that?
I think it's a common phenomenon. But also, there's, say I'm 86, there's a breakdown in the sense of the divisions of time between past, present, and future. The future is problematical, and the present is rather meditative because I'm not involved in an active job. And I read and wander around the house and garden and do things that don't interfere with any kind of meditative process. So there's nothing to prevent the accidental memory from getting into your mind. And I do think memories are attached. Something brings them up. They don't usually force their way up like air through water. But I have had a sense of that the past is no longer different from the present, that I can live in the past as I live in the present. I think some part of my life that I enjoyed very much, and I think, well, enjoy it. It's still here. You're in it, even though the people I haven't seen for 30 years.
William Maxwell speaking with Terry Gross in 1995. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's hear more of Terry's interview with writer William Maxwell. This year, the Library of America is publishing a 2-volume collection of his novels and short stories. The first comes out this month.
You know, in the story that we were reading from before, what he was like, one of the characters describes himself as being in the age of funerals, or is always going to
yes.
funerals. Have you outlived a lot of your friends?
Yes. I have outlived 3 very close friends, and I think about them quite often. I've also outlived people of the older generation who were very kind and did wonderful things for me that I think of with love and gratitude.
Some people really say that people who they've loved who have passed are still with them in a way that they never expected. Do you ever feel that way?
Spooks, you mean?
Well, I don't mean like actual ghosts, but just feeling somebody's presence.
Yes. It's people often speak of it, really, and they speak of it as if they don't entirely rule out the possibility of ghosts. I think there's another way that people are kept, and that is someone who's especially dear to you, so dear that you can't face the idea of never seeing them again. You take on certain of their qualities. My mother was a very outgoing, hospitable, and quite happy woman. And I'm rather introverted and tend to be shy with strangers and like to be alone, like to read. And when she died, I was only a little boy, and I wasn't ready to give her up. And I haven't given her up. I think about her quite often. As I'm older, I remember her face more vividly. But I also am aware that I have a kind of sociable life. I don't say that it isn't me, but it's the part of me that developed because I took part of her into my nature rather than let her die.
It was a long time ago that she died. It was 1918 or
19. Immense time ago.
Yeah. You've written about her a lot.
Yes.
So you think you became more sociable?
I think so. happy with people, because she was always happy with people.
Losing her when you were, I think it was 10 years old, to the flu epidemic, it must have made you think that at any moment someone who you love could just suddenly disappear. Because people were dying all around during that epidemic. I mean, so many Americans died. Were you always, like, bracing for that?
After that?
Mm-hmm.
No. My father was a very strong character and a physically strong man. And once when I was a little boy, I was in a boat on the Illinois River with my father and mother, and he was fishing, and we were far out in the middle of the river, and a sudden thunderstorm came up, and there were white caps on the waves, and it was quite a way back to the dock. And my father said to get down the bottom of the boat, and my mother was a heavy woman, so we had to pull quite a lot to get her in a hurry through the water. However, we stepped out of the boat just as the cloudburst came down. And as long as he lived, and I think I have it still, the feeling of being safe because of him, safe because he was an honest man, safe because he was a decent man, and safe because he was physically strong. So what the effect my mother's death had on me was really that things happen that you don't want to happen, that you can't bear to have happen, and that you must somehow learn that there is no way to get around that fact. So I learned to live with the things that can't be undone.
Well, you know, speaking of things that can't be undone, that leads me to another story in your new collection, and it's a story based on a memory, based on something that happened. The story is called The Holy Terror.
Yes.
And you wrote it in 1985 after the death of your older brother. I'm sorry, you wrote it in 1986 after his death in 1985. I think I have that right.
Close enough.
Yeah, okay. And what happened was when you were very, very young, your brother was trying to... when you were very, very young, your aunt was leaving in a horse and buggy, and your brother, who was a boy, wanted to go with her.
About five.
And what he tried to climb up onto the buggy, and what happened?
Well, she didn't know he was there. He climbed up the wheel, and she was talking to my mother. And she finished her sentence and cracked the whip to make the horse move forward, and the wheels turned. And my brother slipped, and his... leg got caught in the wheel, and his leg was broken. And what I was told, I presume by my father, but somehow or other I acquired the information that it was broken in so many pieces that they had to cut it off. And it wasn't until I was in my 20s that an uncle who was a doctor told me that, in fact, it was a simple fracture that not once in 100 times ever required an amputation. But the family doctor was a drug addict because they used to dispense medicine, so they had access to drugs. And he didn't set the leg properly, and gangrene had set in, and that's why they had to cut it off. But my brother didn't know this, I'm quite sure. And I don't think his family knew it while he was alive.
Well, he never knew that?
No.
Boy, it would have been really hard for him to live with that.
It would have been unbearable. And I managed to keep the secret while we were both alive.
Was it hard for you to keep it a secret?
No, I had no desire. I just had a fear that he might find out, but I knew he wouldn't find out through me.
This is the kind of story I always find really frightening, in the sense that so many people have the kind of lives in which in one moment they made one foolish move that cost them something very dear that they could never get back.
Yes.
Like a leg.
And the price seems to be so disproportionate to the offense.
But a story like that can paralyze you. It can make you feel like, I better not make any move in case I make the wrong move.
I know, but we're animals and we have to move.
What you write in your story was that watching what happened to your brother changed you. You say, I became a more tractable, more even-tempered, milder person than it was in my true nature to be.
I think this is true, but it is not my perception. It was something which was said to me when I was in analysis by the psychoanalyst. He thought that there was a fierce character inside my rather gentle exterior, and that the reason that that exterior was so gentle was because the fierce character saw what happens to little. My brother didn't just climb on that wagon. He smoked cigars when he was 2 or 3, and he was he was hell on wheels.
Right.
Yes.
Really willful.
My father had to lock up his cigar case.
Oh gosh.
And he was 3 years old. And he turned the hose on the women of the family. He was full of beans, but then look what happened to him. So, I think it might have. I can't swear to these things. Who can swear to anything psychological? It might have made me more quiet and gentle and bookish. But perhaps those were just my genes. I don't know. Who knows?
The late writer William Maxwell speaking with Terry Gross in 1995. This year, the Library of America is publishing a 2-volume collection of his work. We'll hear more of William Maxwell in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, presenting daily book reviews, author interviews, and more in the Barnes & Noble Review, online at bn.com. From Kauffman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, celebrating entrepreneurs who start businesses and change the world, on the web at kauffman.org. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and health care of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we hear more of Terry's 1995 interview with the late writer William Maxwell. David Edelstein reviews the Romanian film 4 Months, 3 Weeks, and 2 Days. The film follows a young woman as she helps her roommate get an abortion. The procedure was illegal under dictator Nicolae Ceaușescu. And Lloyd Schwartz reviews a newly released live recording by opera soprano Patricia Brooks. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, in for Terry Gross. Let's continue Terry's 1995 interview with writer and editor William Maxwell. This year, the Library of America will publish a 2-volume collection of his novels and short stories. Volume 1, which collects his early work, is out now. Reynolds Price has said about Maxwell's stories, "We're held in the arms of a huge, benign host who wills us only an elegant pleasure, a deepened vision of our lost past, and a comprehending mercy now in the smaller world of our diminished present."
From 1936 to 1975, you were a fiction editor at the New Yorker magazine. And since we're talking so much about memory, maybe you could remember for us a little bit what it was like to be at the New Yorker back in 1936.
It was a wonderful place. I was hired to see artists. That was the technical name for it. And there, at the moment, didn't seem to be any office space, so they put me in a bullpen, in a corner facing a drawing on the wall by Thurber of himself. But it was outside Mrs. White's office, and so I heard quite a lot that went on in the office. And she was a rather stately woman, very handsome and very stately, and when private matters were being discussed, she would get up from her desk in a stately fashion and walk to the doorstop and release it, and then between the time it took a rather slow door to close, I heard quite a lot. Anyway, she hired me, and Catherine White and Evie White and Wilkett Gibbs and Ross and Thurber, all half a generation older than I was. And I never felt that I was responsible for the making of the magazine. But I admired them. I also had reservations because I was already a novelist when I got there. And I read enormously. And I saw that there were certain areas that they were unwilling to touch.
Like what?
Well, it was astonishing now. They've long since got over that inhibition. But they wouldn't publish a story that involved the Jewish question. They wouldn't involve a story that involved homosexuality. There were several things that they felt simply inappropriate, which was formed a kind of straitjacket. Eventually, of course, everything and every kind of language has crept into the New Yorker. But this is the way it was when I went to work there.
Did you try to talk to anybody about that?
I didn't ever talk to anybody anything, but I did. I did once write a story about a young boy who was masturbating and feeling very guilty about it. I didn't have any physical descriptions that, at all, but it was related to his fear of God and to the uncertainty of being adolescent and so forth. Anyway, I submitted it, and the fiction editor at that time thought it was written by somebody else, and he came to my office in a fury, outraged that anybody should write about masturbation, and even though they didn't mention the word or describe anything physically. Then he discovered in the midst of the conversation that it was I, not the other person who'd written the story. And so there we were faced with each other. I couldn't unwrite the story. He couldn't undo what he had said. And when he went home and told his wife, she said, "Well, either you'll be better friends or you won't."
And which was it?
We lived through it all right.
So what happened with the story?
It was published elsewhere. It was published during the war. There was a kind of literary quarterly. I don't remember the name of it, but various people had charge of it at one time or another. And Irwin Edmund, the Columbia philosopher, was the editor for an issue, and he published it. And you know, nothing happened. Nothing bad happened. I didn't get. Nobody got any bad mail about it. It was a very delicate, discreetly worded story. But the New Yorker was full of eccentric taboos at that time.
As a fiction editor at the New Yorker, was it your responsibility to carry out certain parameters of discretion, you know, to respect certain parameters of discretion, so to speak, that you didn't really respect yourself?
I didn't have to carry them out. I just had to submit to them. For example, there was a John Cheever story which had the sentence in it, Coverley, with love in his heart and lust in his trousers, walked across the lawn. And the editor at that time, William Shawn, said it couldn't be published. I thought it could be published. I didn't see why it couldn't be published. I thought it was a wonderful sentence, but it didn't get published.
Shawn won. Of course, I suppose.
Yes. Yes. He had all the cards, but I think Wright was on my side.
So what was that exchange with Shawn like? Were you in his office talking with him? Was this a back and forth on paper that happened?
It was in his office. He put it in on a when the manuscript came back, he said it should be cut, and so I went to his office to explain I should be didn't think it should be cut. And I thought it was a good sentence. So he said it shouldn't, and I said it should stay in the story. And he said it shouldn't. So I just gave up and walked out of the office. What more could I do? I knew him well enough to know he wasn't going to change his mind.
And what did Cheever have to say about it?
I think I told John and apologized, but that's all that he had many grievances against the New Yorker, but that doesn't seem to have been one of them.
Writer William Maxwell recorded in 1995. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1995 interview with the late writer William Maxwell. For 40 years, he was fiction editor at The New Yorker.
Did you feel like a New Yorker working at The New Yorker? You were from a small town in Illinois.
When I first went to work, I felt very different from them. At that particular moment, three plays of Noel Coward had just opened with Gertrude Lawrence, and there was a great deal of conversation about going to the opening nights, and I didn't go to opening nights. I'd never seen a Noel Coward play. I felt from the hinterlands. And in a sense, I remained from the hinterlands, but I stopped worrying about it and felt that's who I am, that's where I belong, and what the hinterlands have to offer is something as good as anywhere else. But I don't think I ever became, in any sense, I never felt sophisticated. And they were, rather. But strangely, only in certain areas. In other areas, they weren't. For example, E.B. White he did read Anna Karenina, but it took him 3 years. And he was not a reader at all. The whole vast areas of English and American classics were outside his experience, which isn't sophistication, is it?
Right.
But he's a very, very sophisticated writer.
I think of how much the world has changed since you were a boy, from, you know, horse and buggies to, you know, moonwalks and portable computers and all of that. Do you feel like you still make an effort to keep up with all the big changes, technological and otherwise, or is it not important to you now?
I don't say I make an effort not to keep up, but I certainly don't make any effort to keep up. For example, I use a typewriter, not a computer.
Mm-hmm.
Joseph Mitchell, my colleague at The New Yorker, is fond of a Quaker phrase, which is very convenient when there's something, some current manifestation. He says, it doesn't speak to my condition. And if you're 86, of course, lots of contemporary things don't speak to your condition. Your condition is placed 30, 40, 50, 60 years earlier. I liked the world I came into as a child. My father liked new things. He thought all the new inventions were marvelous. And in general, I've tended to hate them. I would so gladly put an end to all flying machines, all automobiles, all mechanical means of locomotion except the horse and buggy. It was a beautiful world. I loved the sound of a horse clop, cloppity, clop, clop going past the house. It was unhurried. It left time for brooding and thought. It left time for being nice to other people. It left time for making presents instead of buying them. It left time for telling stories.
I don't know if this is an answerable question or not, but what has given you the most pleasure about getting older, and what has been the most painful or most sad for you about it?
Nothing has been sad, strangely, but it's because the most serious losses haven't occurred. My wife is 13 years younger than I am, and she is still beautiful. She takes wonderful care of me. And so in the center of the operation, things are still secure. I don't mind. When I wrote that story about the man who kept a diary, I did, in fact, look out of the window and see children running down the street and think how wonderful it would be to run like that. But I've accepted the fact that I'm not going to run like that. And the other day, I went to the theater with a friend, and there were no taxis. It was a matinee, and there were no taxis. And we walked and walked and walked and walked. And finally, as we got close to Grand Central, I saw a stopped taxi with a light on and realized somebody was about to get out of it. And I ran. And I was so happy I could run. I don't say I ran very fast, but I covered the ground and I got there before somebody else did. I love so many things about being old. For one thing, I'm quite charitable about most people and most things, and equally charitable toward my own shortcomings. And it makes for a pleasant state of mind. I love reading, and you can read. My eyesight's still fine. And I love gardening, and my knees, I'm able to kneel on. And so the wonderful opening out of memory, the wonderful fact that you look back over such a long period, is like having a marvelous novel. And my health is on the whole fine. So I think old age is a minefield, but I've only stepped on one or two mines during that period.
So interesting to hear you talk about this. I feel like we get such mixed messages about aging. On the one hand, we all want to live a long time.
Yes, it is curious, isn't it?
And on the other hand, older people are always saying, whatever you do, don't get old.
No, I don't feel that way. I wouldn't have missed it for anything.
Well, William Maxwell, it's been a delight to talk with you. I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Writer William Maxwell speaking with Terry Gross in 1995. The Library of America has just published the first of a 2-volume collection of his novels and stories. Soprano Patricia Brooks was never as well known as Beverly Sills, her contemporary and friend at the New York City Opera in the 1960s. But she was highly prized among opera lovers, not only for her voice, but as one of opera's most gifted actresses. She didn't make many recordings, so classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says he's especially pleased at the new release of a live recital from 1971.
Some performances are so indelible that even after many years you can't forget them. I can still picture in my mind the way Patricia Brooks handled a champagne glass in director Frank Corsaro's famous 1969 production of Verdi's La Traviata at the New York City Opera. Brooks had an unusual background for an opera singer. She was both a dancer with Martha Graham's company and an actress. She studied with the great Uta Hagen and appeared off-Broadway in José Quintero's legendary Circle in the Square production of Eugene O'Neill's The Iceman Cometh. Violetta, the heroine of La Traviata, is a tubercular courtesan. Brooks played her as world-weary and cynical, threatened by the love of her naive suitor, Alfredo. At the end of the first act, she resists her sentimental impulse to fall in love and tries to talk or sing herself back into her ruthless pursuit of sheer pleasure. Brooks sipped her champagne as if she were sipping at the well of love itself. Maybe she sings, "Alfredo is the one." But no, honest feeling is impossible. Absurd. I must remain free, Violetta sings. and as if she had to shake off this temptation in the most violent way, Brooks smashed the champagne glass on the floor. Few sopranos ever sing this passage, ever act it with such desperation, or with greater theatrical skill. But Brooks never recorded this role. Most of her performances remain only in the memory of those who saw them. Now VAI has released a CD of her 1971 New York recital debut, and we can hear again her extraordinary sweetness and sensitivity, as, for example, in this atmospheric Mahler song, in which breathing in the scent of a lime tree twig becomes an act of love. Brooks could also rise to heights of tragic grandeur, as in this aria from Meyerbeer's rarely performed Robert le Diable. Patricia Brooks's opera career was cut short in 1977 by the onset of multiple sclerosis, which affected her breathing. She died in 1993 at the age of 59. I'm not aware of any film with Patricia Brooks. I wish I could see again how gracefully and with how much character she moved. But this lovely new disc, with its unclichéd selection of songs and arias in German, Italian, and French, stylishly accompanied by pianist Harriet Wingreen and oboist Bert Lucarelli, is a powerful reminder of what a cherishable artist she was.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor at the Boston Phoenix and teaches English at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He reviewed Patricia Brooks in recital on the VAI label.
Thank you.
Coming up, David Edelstein on the Romanian film 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days. This is Fresh Air. The title of the Romanian film, 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days, refers to the point in her pregnancy when a young woman in communist Bucharest attempts to procure an abortion. The film, which opens today in New York and Los Angeles, won the top prize at last year's Cannes Film Festival and was named the best foreign language film of the year by the National Society of Film Critics. Our film critic, David Edelstein, has this review.
4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days is set in Romania in 1987, 2 years before the dictator Nicolae Ceausescu's violent fall, and is part of director Cristian Mungu's series Tales from the Golden Age. The Golden Age was Ceausescu's name for his quarter-century reign, and 10 minutes of this movie is enough to tarnish the label for all time. The film unfolds over one long day, which begins with a university student, Otilia, waking up in her dorm, brushing her teeth, bargaining for a pack of black market cigarettes, and setting off to orchestrate an illegal abortion for her roommate. That roommate, Gabita, is a pretty and childlike creature who has left many of the logistics to her friend. So in the course of the movie, Otilia must have protracted and humiliating negotiations with sadistically indifferent hotel clerks, a predatory male abortionist, and even her well-off boyfriend, who insists on her presence that evening at his mother's birthday dinner. Through it all, Otilia's powerlessness is more and more palpable, and as she struggles to keep her focus, the camera stays fastened on her. Long, grueling takes in which her dogged persistence becomes increasingly heroic. 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days centers on the subjugation of women, but the plight of Otilia and Gabita is also a window on a society in which everyone is stunted, in which fear has metastasized into malignant self-interest. Everyone but Otilia is out for him or herself. Everyone has moral tunnel vision. The danger in this sort of sociological filmmaking is that the characters will seem like specimens in a jar, or fish in an aquarium, which is actually the first image of the film. But it's fascinating to study the ways in which these particular sea creatures have adapted to this repressive regime. Even the monstrously exploitive abortionist, Bebe, played by Vlad Ivanov, is a strangely compelling figure. He has a shtick, and it hinges on the conviction that his clients regard him as a moron and will take advantage of him. We don't forgive him for his actions, but we understand how he evolved in Ceausescu's golden age. We see how he justifies those actions to himself. Last year's Romanian critics' darling, The Death of Mr. Lazarescu, depicted a similarly dead-souled Romania, seen through the prism of a poor, disagreeable old man's last hours as he shuttled from one uncaring medical facility to the next. It was powerful, but it was basically a single morbid hospital joke stretched to 3 hours. 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days portrays a more complex ecosystem. Mungu moves between huge, empty, decrepit buildings, once presumably glorious, and characterless modern apartment towers. It's almost impossible to reconcile the country's past with its present. There's no music, only the thunk of radiators, the echo of shoes on uncarpeted floors, and unforgettably, the sound of a small object as it bumps down a garbage chute. As Otilia, Anna Maria Marinka is remarkable. There isn't a trace of tremulousness. Somehow, the more frozen her face, the more of her soul is bared. You want her not just to survive, but to survive with her humanity intact. You pray for her, you pray for everyone, to transcend the collective venality, or failing that, to emerge from this golden age with the determination to capture it in works of art, as in this great, unsparing film.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shorrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Fairby is our administrative assistant. Jonathan Menhevar directed the show. Our digital production project supervisor is Julian Hertzfeld. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. We'll close with music performed and written by composer and tenor saxophonist Benny Golson. He was born 79 years ago today. This is I Remember Clifford, which he wrote in tribute to the jazz trumpeter Clifford Brown. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of Touchstone, a novel of suspense and intrigue set in Britain between two world wars by Laurie R. King, author of The Game. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems at pewtrusts.org. And from Netflix and Sony Pictures Home Entertainment, presenting Resident Evil, Extinction, available today on DVD at Netflix.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In 1960, presidential candidate John F. Kennedy asked the nation to disregard his religion. In 2000, George W. Bush stated Jesus was his favorite philosopher. How did faith become such an important criteria for the presidency? On the next Fresh Air, historian Randall Balmer talks about his book, God and the White House. Join us for the next Fresh Air.